Welcome to G220 Radio. My name is Mike, and I am riding solo. Nathaniel is getting ready for a big trip, and Ricky, who is doing all the streaming stuff for me, is on their side, still not getting better, but not ready to bless us with his presence on the YouTube, at least visually. So here I am by myself. At least it should go good since Ricky's running all of it. But this is episode number 443. We're going to be talking about Gregory of Nazianzus, or Gregory the Great, and standing strong for Nicene Orthodoxy. And this is kind of the second podcast I've kind of devoted for introducing the church fathers. The first episode was episode 388 on Polycarp and Irenaeus. Go listen to that one as we looked at two very early very early theologians, pastors, and their life and their influence on Christianity very early on. And every once in a while, I like to, if I have kind of the opportunity to do it, is to devote some time into understanding the church fathers. First off, because I want to know more about the church fathers. I think it's important to understand where they are, how they help us to better understand really the fundamentals of our faith. The church fathers are early on. They are thinking through very important issues that we still deal with today. Jehovah's Witnesses believe in Arianism. We'll talk about a little bit more about Arianism in a little bit. And, well, they're nothing new. Arius is a 4th century believer, or heretic, to be better, who claimed to be a believer. And here, these being dealt with. Oneness theology, or modalism, is also not new. It is a 4th century development. We will see, even in our time period, the denying of Christ in either his natures. Either he is not God in Arianism, or that he is not a rational human. He's not like us. All of these are going on really early. The church has to grind its teeth on heresy very, very early. So it's important for us. And I think sometimes, and me, is that we tend to stop our history at 1517 or just before that, or maybe even Jan Hus 100 years before that. But the faith has been delivered once for all, and it's passed down, and we can look at the early church fathers. We can look at the church fathers. We can look at also the Middle Ages and see the development of histories, where the faith is steering off, where it's being corrected, and to think more deeply about very essential doctrines of the faith. So that's our goal. We're going to think about one person in particular so that we can understand the fight for orthodoxy, to stand firm when heresy abounds, and how we do it. So we'll talk about Gregory, but let's dive into his word. Let's check out and see what he's about. What is he dealing with? So when Gregory is born, Constantine is the emperor. And what we should know about Constantine is that he was a pagan who converted to Christianity on a battle. And later, when he becomes emperor, he legalizes Christianity. And this has multiple effects. There's a lot of effects with it. You have certainly a rise in monastic movements. And this idea of separating oneself, denying oneself. The desert fathers come in mind, those who went to the desert and would be out there for long times, depriving themselves of food and water and entertainment. So you have the rise of the asceticism, you have the rise of the monastic movement in which they would come together and then devote themselves, depriving themselves, but devoting themselves to the study of scripture and to prayer. And this is because in light, you kind of have what we would call a cultural Christianity. Well, now that Constantine's a Christian and Christian is now a legal religion, people become Christians for political means. And so you have this influx of Christians who aren't striving for holiness, who aren't concerned about theology. This is the context which George Gregory, the theologian or of Nazianzus, is. And within that, you then have the rise of kind of two heresies. The major one, and the heresy of what we could call the East or the Greek-speaking part of the church, is Arianism. And Arianism is developed by Arius in Alexandria. At the time, Alex of Alexandria is the bishop. And seeing these teachings, he kicks Arian out. Arian flees over to Caesarea. Eusebius of Caesarea is there. And this becomes a growing movement. In the West, at the same time, you have this idea of Sabellitism, of modalism growing. Modalism teaches that God shows himself in different modes. You have the Father, you have God as the Son, and you have God as the Holy Spirit. But they're the same person. They connect the nature and person. Only one person, only a nature can have one person assigned to it. So you have God, and he has these different titles in which he shows himself to us. And so you have that problem in the West, the Latin church. And so you have these two major heresies. Now there's others around, and we'll mention some others, but those are the prominent ones. Well, in 325, because of the growth of the Arian heresy, Constantine sets a council in Nicaea. And we know this is the Nicene Council. It's the first ecumenical council. And they overwhelmingly affirm that Arianism is heresy. It is wrong. And it's not even a close decision. Eusebius of Caesarea stands up and gives a defense for Arius because Arius is not a bishop. He cannot talk. But it is Alexander of Alexandria who leads the charge here at the council, and the bishops overwhelmingly deem it. Characters there that we know is Athanasius is there with Alex of Alexandria in this fight. Athanasius will take up the mantle and continue to fight Arianism. But just because a council says Arianism is a heresy doesn't mean that Arianism is now over with. In fact, what we see is Constantine becomes an Arian, and other rulers and emperors until Julian the Apostate are Arians. They are favorable to Arius's cause. This is why Athanasius is exiled 5 times from Alexandria. And there is a sense in which Arianism becomes the dominant view of the church, at least the Eastern church. And so you have Athanasius who rises up and fights against Arianism. He is writing against it. And then you have probably 3 other notable characters, though there are more, is Gregory of Nazianzus, who we're talking about, and the 2 other Cappadocian fathers. So as a 3, they're known as the Cappadocian fathers. So it's Gregory, it is Basil of the Great, or Basil of Caesarea, and then Basil's brother is also named Gregory. He's Gregory of Nazianzus. And so those 3 in that area write treatises defending the Trinity and Trinitarian views. they formulate them differently. We have an episode in which I talk about Basil the Great's formulation of the Trinity. You can check that out on our Podbean or here on YouTube. But those are the three. And so they fight for in between this time. Also, and kind of particular in which in the area we're talking about in modern day Turkey, you have the Pneuma Mataki, which is literally the spirit fighters. They're a kind of continuation of Arianism in which they deny the divinity of the Holy Spirit. They're more prominent in Basil's writing, but they are a rising group in this area, and no doubt Gregory encounters and writes against them. Like I said, you have then Julian the Apostate comes up, and his whole goal during this time is to revert the Roman Empire back to paganism. Roman Empire has certainly fallen from its glory days, and Julian the Apostate would go out and say, if we want to be like we were, we need to go back to paganism. What's interesting about Julian the Apostate is that he was a Christian. He professed to be a Christian before his apostate. But Gregory, who we're talking about today, knew him in Athens in his time and doesn't want to call himself a prophet, but saw that Julian was not a Christian, that he had subversive ideas, even in Athens, before it kind of came out that he went to the pagans. And then what we see here and what is Gregory's most important part of his life is in 381, the Council of Constantinople is called by Theodos to kind of deal with the Arian heresy again. And from that point on, the Arian heresy is on retreat and is falling out of favor with the bishops of the day. And so that's the context. You have heresies just like today. Heresies abound. The church is fighting for its kind of position, its theology, trying to make the proper distinctions. And so when we will see kind of here in his life, this his stand. Now, just on the onset, Gregory of Nazianzus, he's not a perfect man. He is a sinful human being. But we can still learn from him. We can see how God used him and learn from him so that we can pursue holiness. We can pursue Christ even more than what we have right now. So Gregory, we don't know when Gregory was born. Using some timeline information, we can kind of ballpark it around 325 to 330 AD. So just around the time Constantine brings the bishops over for the Council of Nicaea. So around that time and a little later. And he is raised in a Christian family. His father was involved in a small cult called the Hypostarians. Now, we don't know much about him outside of what Gregory of Nazianzus and Gregory of Nyssa mention. We don't know much. What we do know is there's some kind of Oriental or pagan connection with Christian and Jewish sources. So they believed God was one. They were monotheistic in that way. But they just kind of picked and choose. It's a small cult. It has no influence in kind of the Nazian area. What is interesting about his father is his father is converted because of the influence of his wife, Nana, or the mother of Gregory. And he will later become a bishop in Nazianzum and would even kind of, as Gregory would say, kind of with a violence, a soft violence, make him part of his kind of his ruling class. His father, who's also named Gregory, there's a lot of Gregories here. Gregory's father wanted him to help him with his bishop and kind of set him up to be the bishop after him. What we know about his mother is obviously she is one who shares her faith. She has an influence on not only her husband. So for you wives out there who have unconverted husbands, take strength in this. Pray for him. But what we also know about his mother is that his mother was raised in a Christian home. And so she has the Christian faith. She passes the Christian faith on to her children, which is Gregory, who's the middle child. He has a sister and a brother. Both of them were in the faith. His brother was a great physician. He was called into the courts of Constantinople as a physician. He would leave his post because of temptations that could throw off his faith. So we see a family that is influenced by not only a mother, but also a father. And to stop and think about that for a little bit here. Now, we did a podcast, episode 439, just a few weeks ago, on leading your family spiritual, and it was geared towards men and leading their family and to grow. And what we see here in church history, and not just with Gregory, but I mean, John Chrysostom and Athanasius are examples that, and one resource I had when I was going through said, but we can think of stories of like Calvin and Spurgeon. And Bunyan and others that had influences from their parents. And kind of the stories that I can think of and recall in memory seem overwhelmingly that God uses people and that majority of them have influences, especially mothers. Think of Wesley, even Dr. Al Mohler at Southern Seminary. His family and devoted him in the Christian life. You have these children who become stalwarts in the Christian faith, who God brings about and uses for great things. But those are, you know, extreme. There are very few. But what we can take hope in is that even if our sons and our daughters, we pour our spiritual life into them and to raise them up in the fear and admiration of the Lord, we will have, like these men, influences beyond our years, that we teach our children, and they teach their children and their children. And we see this even in the promises in Deuteronomy about the wicked will be punished to their third and fourth generation because they continue to teach this wickedness and sin and to rebel against God. But those who remain steadfast, their prosperity, their children are honored because they're taught the way of the Lord and they have faith and trust in it. So parents, be encouraged. It's, as we mentioned there on that podcast, it is hard work. It is a long work. And your children may not show fruits of repentance for majority of their life. But be faithful. Pray for your children. Keep admonishing them and admonishing them in the Lord. And when God chooses to save them, he will. And you will be the means by which God chooses to save them, because you have direct influence. And they will then be able to teach their children the greatness of God. So Gregory, if you see, is raised in with a Christian household, goes to school. He is a learned man. He first goes to Caesarea, which is in modern day Turkey. This is where he meets Basil of Caesarea. And shortly after that, he will go to Palestinian Caesarea, which is on the Mediterranean coast in Palestine. This would be the leading providence in the day of Jesus, in the days of Jesus. So there's this connection there. And there they had a school on rhetoric. And he would stay there and he would learn rhetoric. This is to learn how to speak, to give presentations. And this is important for his life. All we really have of Gregory is his sermons, his orators, and letters. So it is during this time that he is learning how to speak publicly. And God's going to mightily use that, as we'll see. There are times in which Gregory will have to stand up and make stands, and he will do it in a sermon, and it's going to be powerful. God is using a gift that he has learned, that he's honed in. After he gets done in Palestine, he goes to Alexandria. Most likely he is there during Athanasius' second exile. There's no evidence he actually met Athanasius while he was in Alexandria. But he's also not there for a very long time. He will move from Alexandria to Athens, in which he will attend more school. In philosophy, he is learning and learning in all of that. While he's on his way to Athens, though, he suffers a shipwreck. It's to note that he's in such a hurry, he doesn't wait for favorable shipping times. So they're off the coast of Cyprus, and it's during this time, while the ship is being torn and tossed about in the waves in the Mediterranean Sea, that Gregory devotes himself by pledging, or he pledges to God to devote himself to the study of God and to be baptized. There is a sense in which he may not have done this right away afterwards. That might have been later on in his life. But he pledges. And he goes to Athens. He meets up with Basil, who has come to Athens through Constantinople. And they are there. He writes about some of the dealings of the university in his sermon on the death at the funeral of Basil in 271. And so we kind of get a little bit of it, of what is going on. And one thing we learn is the devotedness here of Gregory. We said he kind of pledged his kind of devotedness. He will do it again. But to think about Athens, it's a worldly city. They have a hippodrome. They have plays and parties and festivals and fairs and all the other things that can catch the eyes of worldly people or to anyone and to bring them in. We learn that Gregory only knew two streets in all of Athens. Now, probably this is somewhat of an exaggeration, but to point the devotedness is that there was the one that led to the church in which they could meet and learn and to study in the sacred, and then also one to the university in which she would go to lectures and to learn there. And that they would spend their time doing this. And we can note that this is what he wants to do, but I think there is some things that we can learn from kind of our perspective to think about it. And this idea of devotedness. And when kind of thinking through this and looking at it, it really kind of causes the question, how devoted am I? Now, this isn't to say that we can't enjoy the recreation and some world, like earthly pleasures, as it may be. But I think what we can see and what we can consider is, do those worldly pleasures distract me from my godly pursuit? There's no doubt that studies have shown that social media destroys the attention span of people. The quickness of things, it's short clippets of videos where people cannot devote themselves to deep and hard thinking. And so we end up with shallow platitudes, as we may say. And this is something I deal with in my own life and trying to just not even religious activities of church, just trying to say focus for an hour in church, let alone when you work or homework or other things in it. And so we need to, as Christians, understand there's this devotedness to dig deeper, to go further, and to make a point to learn, not only by reading the Bible and understanding what it says, but other books given to us. For example, the orations of the Trinity, of Gregory, and to see and to read what it is, and to really think about what we're doing, not just going through the motions, but to focus and to think and to try to go further than just simple actions with it. And this will become important in Gregory's life. It is his times when he visits Basil at his monastery. It is these times in which he learns to stop and to think and to be devoted and to study and deep study. And this is what's going to help him not only with his rhetoric, but to, in connection with his rhetoric, to say, to allow him to deliver these phenomenal sermons. So it's not only that he's good at rhetoric, he is theologically grounded and he has thought through these things in which he now professes. After his time in Athens, he's probably there somewhere around 18 years. I'm trying to remember. He's there for a little while. And I mentioned earlier, he meets Julian, who the apostate there, though he hasn't apostatized at that point. But there comes a point in which he then moves back to Nazianzum and becomes a coadjutor with his father. And basically, it was a training program for the next bishop. It was a position and kind of a plan of succession for a bishop. During this time, he is going back between Basil's monastery that he has before he's called to be the bishop of Caesarea and helping his father out. And during this time, his father makes him a priest. And when he becomes a priest, he runs away to Basil. He doesn't want to be a priest. After thinking and meditating and talking to Basil, he comes back and on an Easter sermon delivers his apology for what he did and how irresponsible that he was for it. And he will spend then his time there between the two until about 379. And in 379, you have Theodotus, who is the emperor in the east. He is reigning in Constantinople. And he is looking for a powerful theologian. Constantinople has been ravished by the Arian heresy. Emperors after emperors, and then Julian the apostate, just destroyed the holiness, any resemblance of orthodoxy in Constantinople. It was so bad that, like, the worldly pleasures and the church were indistinguishable. They were synchronistic. They didn't really care about the gospel. They just asked surface questions about it. And not only did you have the Arian heresy, there are all others heresies which are based off or is found that have come off of the Arian heresy. You have people who are denying that Christ has a reasonable soul, that he was just a human, like he not even appeared, that he was a human, but he didn't have a reasoned soul like you did. He would have had the soul of God in him. And so Constantinople has just been secularized, to use a modern term for that. And so Theodosius is looking for a powerful theologian to come in and to defeat the Arians. And Gregory is this way. He has been dealing with heresies in Nazianzum. He has already written or spoke about peace and trying to talk about and to bring those who are Orthodox together and to stop bickering with each other. And so he wants them to come. And another issue with it, so not only do you have the heresies, you have people who are very learned, but they haven't connected their knowledge to the heart. It hasn't produced an orthodoxy. Again, like I said, surface level questions of the gospel with that, it's not a good time. So he comes in, and here he would preach five orations on theology, which upheld Trinitarian doctrine, orthodoxy. This was a treatise you can buy, just these orations together. But it was a powerful, powerful oration. It was so powerful that the Arians hired mercenaries to try to kill him. Tried to assassinate him. They were not pleased with it. But not only did he talk against Arianism, he also spoke against modalism. Again, modalism is still in and around. While it might be more of a Western heresy, there's people all over the empire that would believed it. And so you have these great orations, again, to deal with the Arian heresy. Theodosius would call the Council of Constantinople, which is why the Nicene Creed is often called the Nicene-Constantinople Creed. And again, as another push for the defeat of Arianism and upholding the doctrine set in the Council of Nicaea. By this time, Basil has passed away. Athanasius has passed away. And so while they did a lot of work, now the bishops have come together to kind of finish it off, in a sense. Gregory would become the second president after the first president passed away, and he would stand firm. He would give another oracle towards the end of it, and again, Nicaea was reaffirmed, and the Trinity, the doctrine of Trinity, is brought into a more full explanation of what it is. After this council, he would leave Constantinople to retire in Nazianzus, which he didn't stop writing. He dealt with more heresies, the Apollinarian heresy, which denied nature of Christ. It was a Christological heresy. Skip in my mind right now. He would fight against that, and then he would leave this earthly home to go to his heavenly home in 931 there in Nazianzen. So we see here a man who loved God, who found himself devoted, though we may say he may have went to extremes in some things, getting to a monastic, and maybe a little asceticism. But those times well spent studying and thinking and reading and trying to understand led for the times that he needed to stand strong and to use the skills God has given them to show and to demonstrate that not only the orthodox understanding of the Trinity, but other heresies that arise in connection with. So what are some other things that we can learn for Gregory? One is peace. He spoke on peace, and he wanted those who were like-minded, who were orthodox, to have peace, to be called to peace, to see that they are Catholic small c together, and to join together to fight the leading heresies. Now, we need to understand our differences, and we need to be seeking and working those out. But there's a sense in which, when we think about it, blessed are those who are peacemakers. That there is a call for us to not only preach peace in the sense of preaching the gospel and how man can have peace with God, even though they are sinful human beings. But there's another sense in how we in the church communicate with each other, how we try to sharpen each other. That, in a sense, with peace is love. And those cannot be separated. So we can learn the importance of peace from Gregory. as he tried to unify the fronts against heresy. Another thing we can learn, and I didn't mention this, is that we should read other works. And especially if we want to engage apologetically, we should read the sources that our opponents are reading. We see this when Gregory and Basil read Origen and then put together a collection of excerpts to defend kind of their position from him. And at the same time showing that the heretics were misreading Origen. Now, Origen, and I know I've mentioned this on the show, he is a special character. My first church history teacher mentioned that Origen is both the father of orthodoxy and the father of heresy. There are times in which, while Origen wasn't a heretic, he rubbed up against that line, and people like Arius, who used Origen to defend his position, would push it over and to bring about, or to use them as to justify their heresy. Now, I want to make note that this is for apologetic endeavor. There is no way you can study on every single heresy, false movement in our day today. Now, there are some we should be probably more acquainted with, being modalism with oneness Pentecostalism, just oneness theology, or Arianism with Jehovah's Witnesses, and that we should know, and we should understand their position, and to seek and to understand so that we can apologetically defend. And this is stuff I've done myself. I've read Charles Finney. I've not enjoyed it. But there is a sense in which, in doing so, we can know what they are saying. But if one tries to use, let's say, one of our own, to promote a view that is wrong, having read some of these works, and when you're dealing with that, help build the case and apologetically and to defend the faith. So I think it's important. Now, as I mentioned, you shouldn't be trying to learn every heresy. Learn the ones that you have to deal with. Seek to understand those without neglecting further understanding of what the Bible has to say. In recent weeks, I've thought about how I know kind of modalism and oneness theology, but I don't know if I could accurately defend Trinitarian thought. I mean, I can defend it, but what are their sermon arguments against it, and how would I respond in a way that is thoroughly biblical, especially in light if they want to pull understandings of philosophy into it. So again, reading other saints' works, reading those who oppose you, these are good things and stuff that we can see modeled by Gregory himself. And I think finally, and kind of as I mentioned it, is that we should use our gifts for the advancement of truth, for the advancement of the gospel. Not all will have great oratorical rhetoric speaking, but we're all called to have an answer. We're all called to be ready to give a defense. And so, while having the devoted life, we also need to understand that God has gifted us in different ways to do this, which makes the church an amazing community. That we can come together, we can pool our gifts together and advance the gospel. And, you know, even here at G220, out of the three of us, Ricky, Nathaniel, and myself, Ricky, Nathaniel go out and do street evangelism, open air preaching. While I have gone out and I do not condemn those, and I've gone to the Derby and with them, that is not as, how to say, I'm not one who usually goes out. In my churches, I try to use technology to help. And we all have gifts that we can give. My love of church history and to give that to others, to see the broader. You don't have to love church history, but it should be stuff that we know that we should go, because there's great men that we can learn off like this. And so we should use our gifts as God has given to us to advance truth, to pursue the advancement of the gospel. And that's why here at G220 Radio, we want people to evangelize, to be ready, to engage regularly with unbelievers. And now there may be times where you are able to do that more, and there's times when you are not able to do as often. My current workplace, I work with a lot of believers. Evangelism is not as, I don't get opportunities as much. In my previous job, I worked with all these unbelievers, and I had many opportunities to tell people the gospel, to engage with people in spiritual means. They were quite profitable. And I would have people to come up multiple times and ask me different questions and what I thought about things. So that's what we need to be ready for, but we're to use our gifts in ways that are meaningful and helpful. So I hope you enjoyed this show. To learn more about Gregory of Nazianzus and the many other Gregories that we find in church history, and just to think about this life, to see what made him stand firm, that, you know, ultimately maybe implied, so I'll say it explicitly, is that he believed. He believed in Jesus. And it just wasn't some head knowledge. He wasn't just some ivory tower theologian. He thought others should hold. He saw the connectedness of theology and work and the devotedness that we're to have and to pursue holiness, which is what was displayed in his mother. And so I want to thank you for the show. Join us next week here at 9 p.m. Eastern on YouTube for our next episode. And don't forget to like the stream, subscribe to us. If you want an audio version, you can go to Podbean, and you can always check us out on Facebook. For Ricky, who's running the stream, and Daniel, who has the night off, I am Mike. God bless, and we'll see you next week.